Great. So I have at least one of you who's handed in something for a rephrase that I still need to look at. Most of the questions I think I've seen have already addressed and probably there. Looks like I have a strange aspect ratio of it today, but we'll see. So we're sort of into it now. We have a lot of the basic ideas of quantum mechanics together. So what I want to do is to spend a little time today sort of probing some of the stranger aspects of quantum mechanics. And then I want to sort of follow up in the more practical side of actually looking at the solutions to the hydrogen atom. And from that, we'll think about multiple electron atoms. So if you have chemistry, you will, as we get into the many electron atoms, you will recognize some things. But I hope you'll actually feel more comfortable about where all that stuff came from. Because when you take in chemistry, you start seeing how the electrons fill the atomic orbitals and how that translates into chemical characteristics. It almost seems rather arbitrary because I can't spend the whole class talking to you about quantum mechanics beforehand. But it basically comes straight out of quantum mechanics, and it's really quite amazing. So I don't know how far I'll get today, but we'll see. So let's talk about some of the really fun stuff with quantum mechanics stuff. So just to remind you, right, we're thinking about the particles as waves. If they are waves, they exhibit things like diffraction. Right? So you could imagine having a particle. Think of it as an electron, same thing for photons, but think of it as an electron. And let's remember how we're describing it and what is actually happening. If the beam is made up of particles that are waves, and you think of it as a wave, we know that you'll have diffraction. And we've even seen pictures of diffraction patterns of electrons. So that's really experimental fact. Now, think a little bit on how it is that we're describing this thing. Remember that we have a function that we're using, which we call the wave function, that is complex. And we really can't attribute anything in the real world to that wave function, because it is complex. But Max Born told us, and it seems to work pretty well, to attribute the square of this wave function as being something that's well-defined and attribute, basically, it is the probability density of the particle being at any given point. Okay? And if you want to think about a beam of particles going through a slit, we know that if we were to put a detector here that is able to detect the particles, they would detect something that would look like a diffraction maxima. Right? You would get this broadened out intensity pattern, which you've seen for later. So you're going to see the same thing with electrons, for example. So if I were to plot as a function of distance along here, the intensity of the electrons hitting this detector, or if I want to say, I call it the probability to be a measure this way, and I sort of plot the x's where these electrons are going to hit, if I did a million electrons, you would find them distributed where their intensity pattern is greatest here, but you have sort of a large width here because you have a diffraction now. You okay with that? All right. So far, so good. Now, I think it's easy to sort of imagine this if we have a beam of electrons.
But we can reduce the... I guess you already know this. We can reduce the intensity of the electron beam down to the point where we have single electron at a time. So instead of thinking of it as a beam
a lot of electrons where the whole idea of interference with themselves, even in the slit, so-called diffraction, sort of makes sense. But imagine that I have just a particle gun, and I just shoot one. Does it sink? I shoot another. Does it sink? Now think about it. For each of these particles, if we want to think about single individual things, what do I know? As it goes through, it turns out that if I did a million single shots, I would have this final distribution. In other words, the electron is a wave. It diffracts with itself. It doesn't need a billion other electrons to interact with for influence, okay? Pretty cool if you think about it. That's pretty weird. Okay? So we will get this distribution even for a single electron at a time. Now what's even more interesting is, what do we mean when we say we have an electron? When we say we have an electron, we are really referring to its particle characteristics. We know we have an electron on this detector when that electron does something to this detector. It goes through and ionizes a little bit of silicon and we get a pulse at a particular pixel. Or it interacts with an atom with gold bromide or whatever and causes some chemical reaction and you get a dark spot instead of a bright spot. But in these cases, you're not sampling the wave characteristics of this particle. Right? You're sampling its particle characteristics. You've seen it at a very particular point. So when I say that we have this distribution, it is built up very slowly. When I send the first electron through, I have nothing on that detector. And that electron interacts somewhere. And so I get one spot. But it looks completely arbitrary. It could be anywhere along here. And I have no way of knowing where it's going to interact. When I send the second one through, again, I have no way of knowing when or where that one's going to come, where it's going to interact. And it will also interact, and it will also interact at a point. All I know is that if I did a million of them, I get exactly the intensity probability distribution that quantum mechanics tells me. Okay? So, I mean, in and of itself, maybe that's okay. I hope it bothers you a little bit because it's really very not Newtonian, right? In the Newtonian world, I shoot it, I know where it's going, I can tell you where it's going to be. When it goes through the slit, I mean, this whole idea of a wave, it just is sort of crazy. But in addition to that, for every individual particle, I really have no knowledge about where it's going to go, other than this probability distribution. So that works really well. In fact, we're going to, when we get to the hydrogen atom and we look at multi-electron atoms, we're going to, in a sense, see how well it really works. But it does present us with some problems, because psi now, if we were to consider psi as in some way being associated with this particle, it contains within it a probability distribution where the particle goes, and it's some function, mathematical function. So if you want to think about it, psi square contains that probability, and any individual particle that we send through that slit can interact anywhere up until the moment it interacts. And it can interact with that probability distribution. So in a sense, what we know is that psi has encoded within it a distribution function all the way up until the very moment that the particle interacts. And the very instant that the particle interacts, the wave function changes, because we now have a 100% probability that that particle is interacted at the point where it interacted. So if you want to think about it in probability space, as the particle is traveling, we have this probability distribution all the way up until the instant that we hit the detector, when the probability distribution is a spike of the area of harm. Yes?
It feels like that's entirely
by semantics. What does that actually mean? I don't know. No, I mean, it is very, yeah, so I don't know. We'll talk about it. Maybe it is semantics. Maybe it means it is what we mean by the wave function. Let's probe it a little bit more, though. If it doesn't bother you that this function changes when it interacts, let me phrase it a different way. If I have a very thin slit, this diffraction maximum is very broad. That means that wave function basically could allow the particle to interact way down here, way up there, could be very, very far away. The moment the particle interacts, I know where that particle interacts. The wave function, let's say, collapses. Okay, from this distribution to that point with 100% probability. You have a question?
The overall wave function remains the same for all the electrons that are slit, right? It's only the electrons that are
back. Well, each one would have its own wave function, yeah.
Well, it would look the same when it's going through the diffraction. Right?
Yeah.
So for that system, all the electrons have the same wave pattern.
Yeah. Same particle going, same idea. But they'll interact, you know, different places. You may occasionally get two right on top of each other, but you just get this intensity distribution. This wave function then has extent in space, but the collapse has to happen instantaneously. How does the pixel down here know that the electron did up here and the electron's not getting down here? Instantaneously. So in this interpretation of quantum mechanics, which is known as the Copenhagen interpretation, you have all the quantum possibilities allowed until the moment the quantum process happens. And when that happens, the wave function instantaneously transforms into the one that gives you what happened. And if that bothers you, good. Because it's sort of a discontinuity in time. It's an instantaneous thing. So it is fundamentally bothersome. So if you were to talk to a Copenhagen person...
Actually, I've forgotten what my next slide is here, so let me see what it is. I'll just go with that. So if you talk to someone who is a proponent of this interpretation of quantum mechanics, what they will say is, well, sure, psi has to change instantaneously, but why do you care? You don't ever measure psi. Psi isn't something real. You only need to have well-defined and respecting causality things that you can actually measure. And what can you actually measure? Is psi squared. So it turns out that you can sort of weasel your way around and sort of claim that it's okay if psi has these discontinuities. But it's a little bit disquieting.
And I guess I'm not exactly sure right now. I have to actually talk to some people. But when I was in grad school, and I think now, I mean, this is how you learn quantum mechanics, is quantum, the Copenhagen interpretation. And it has within this sort of strange collapsing wave function for any quantum process. So it's a bit mysterious. Okay, so the same thing happened with photons. You've seen the interference pattern. If you put down some film and you shoot, you reduce the intensity to a single photon at a time, you will get the same intensity pattern. Yeah?
You're saying that the presence of another near mass also is
Yeah. So this is, I was sort of saying it a moment ago, but maybe it's easier thinking about photons and double slit instead of a single slit effect. Yes, we talked about light from here and here interfering and getting the intensity pattern. And when you think of that picture, you're thinking about light coming from the two places simultaneously. Okay. So it's a quantum particle. It's a wave. Each individual photon is a wave. So whether I have a beam of electrons or a beam of photons, if I reduce the intensity to where I have a single particle at a time, I will still get the interference pattern. You don't know which slit it's going to go through. It's a wave. It only goes through a slit if you think of it as a particle. But it's not a particle here. It's a wave. It's not a particle until it interacts with your detector. So in quantum mechanics, you have this wave and it has a non-zero probability of going, it has a 50% probability of going through either slit. And so it does. Through both and interferes with itself. And this isn't crap, this is an experiment. I mean, you can go do this experiment, it really works. Yes?
So the slits of the wave,
you can think of it that way, but I mean, what? When you're describing it mathematically, what happens is it has a possibility of going through either. So when you look at psi, you are summing the amplitude from each of these things. And it's non-zero in each. If I cover this one, it's now zero, and I get a single slip diffraction pattern. But if it's uncovered, you have an amplitude through there. Those amplitudes interfere. When you then calculate psi squared, you get the interference pattern. And it's really bothersome if you're trying to think of it as a particle, or maybe even as a single wave, but it's hard to think of what you mean with a single wave. It's not like a single wave only goes through one slit. So it's hard to get together. Yes.
How come it? Like, what makes it? What makes the wave function collapse? Like, why isn't it if you send one photon through? Why doesn't it show an intensity pattern from one photon? If it's waves.
Because that single photon has wave amplitude, has a probability of passing through each of these, and if you think of it that way and calculate how these two pieces interfere with one another, you get this intensity pattern. And the moment it hits the detector, you don't detect a probability distribution, you're detecting it by demanding that it interact with a particle. And a particle can only interact with one spot. So what would happen with the first proton is you will get it to hit somewhere along here, and I couldn't tell you where. And again, the second one, you have somewhere along here, and I couldn't tell you where. By the time you get to the thousandth, you'll begin to notice you have more of them here, 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 and here. And you'll begin to see a fringe pattern. By the time you do 20 million, you'll have a very fine fringe pattern, just as if you had a laser that was very intense. I don't know how to make it any longer or fuzzier than that. It's a bit like swallowing a porcupine on the skin. I mean, it's terrible. Okay. So, I mean, just philosophically, we live in a world where we have to know how to deal with particles. And we sort of have to know how to deal with mechanical waves by and large. But there's nothing in our experience that you need to evolve and eat deer or have sex or whatever it is that you want to do that means you need to have any understanding of small particles and their wave characteristics. Right? So there's no reason to believe that your brain has to be able to get around this. If that makes you feel any better. I don't know. That's sort of, I mean, it's philosophy for me. It's just sort of, there are things that we have learned to look at realms of the universe that are so far outside of our experience that we've evolved in that it doesn't surprise me that it should seem really weird, right? If we grew up in a world where we move at large fractions of the speed of light, we'd sort of have to think relativistically if we were ever going to kill and cook dinner. But we don't live in that world, so we don't really have to think that way. So, at any rate, if it bothers you, good. If you do electrons, same thing. It's wave. Okay, it's just we're more inclined to think of them as particles. Okay. Now, let us suppose that we have a beam of particles coming one at a time. So I have my electron gun and it's just like bang, bang, bang. And they're coming in one at a time. As we just mentioned, we'll get this interference pattern. Okay? Strangely enough, you could if you cover a slip, you'll get the single slip diffraction pattern. Right? If you cover this slip, you'll get the single slip diffraction pattern sort of behind it. If you remove the cover, you'll get the double diffraction, the interference pattern again. Okay? So the particle knows whether there are two slips or one slip sometimes. Okay? The wave is sensitive to that. Shouldn't be a surprise. Same thing happens with water or light. Now, one of the things that you can try to do is because electrons have electric charge, you could imagine putting a passive detector behind one slip that perhaps is sensitive to the induction of the electron going through it. If you do, you have not covered a slip. It is a non-destructive detector. If you were to put such a detector there, the experiment's been done, you can put it behind the slip, so you are detecting which slip the electron went through after it has passed through the slip, supposedly. The moment you do that, you get this double single slip diffraction pattern. In other words, you destroy the interference pattern the moment you demand knowledge of knowing which slit it goes through. You turn this device off, you go back to this. I'm not making this up. Yes?
Is it like the physical device being in that transduce enough, or?
Well, I mean, I would lie, I think, if I told you that we really understand every aspect of this. I think it's really an accurate area of research, but I believe that the wave function is a very sensitive thing. And when we say it's a non-destructive detector, it doesn't mean that you don't interact. What is induction? You're interacting kind of it. And so even though that electron continues, you have somehow interacted, and I believe that that interaction is sufficient to collapse the wave function. If you want to think of it that way. I'm going to tell you a totally different interpretation in a minute that is even stranger, but probably much more elegant. Yeah.
Can I ask you, like, you sort of the brain, you kind of have to go over it in this space, the whole setup in a sense. So, like, let's say, if you have a detector that spans a very large area.
Yeah.
Would it also have a diffraction pattern and not a diffraction pattern? Because in that diagram, it kind of just looks like, you know, right next to the slit right here.
Oh, you can do this over large distances. If you can build the experiment practically, there's nothing that scale the tone here. I just have to put it on the slide. Okay, so this fact has led to a lot of interesting speculation. If you go to the internet, where all things said are very true, as we all know, you will find entire sections of the internet that talk about things like your awareness or your consciousness of the wave function forces the collapse to happen. Sort of comes out of this kind of thing. Right? In the picture where you are thinking the electron has passed through the slit, and you non-destructively detect which slit it went through is sufficient to collapse the wave function, and you do not appreciate the fact that your detection may tweak the wave function a little bit and cause the collapse. If you believe truly you're not messing with the wave function, then people jump to the conclusion that somehow our knowledge has caused it to collapse. Okay? So, you'll see a lot of stuff about this. There's books and books are written about this. I will maybe talk a little bit more about, yeah.
What exactly does an electron interact with when it passes through a passive detector? It interacts with an electric field, and induction happens, but what does that mean?
In the world of quantum field theory, the fact that you feel a force there at all, you're basically exchanging, you're exchanging what we'll call virtual photons. I mean, there is a bit of a force there. I mean, induction, you're actually causing a bit of an interaction. It doesn't mean that it interacts at a level destructively where that electron is absorbed or destroys the nucleus or something like that. It's just, if I have a current of electricity and I put a wire beside it, I can tell when there's a current there whether it's going to induce some effect on my wire. But that would be a non-destructive detector. So I think that our opinion in the matter probably has nothing to do with it. I think actually there's the idea that you are really non-destructive or doing anything is probably more the problem. I think you actually are. You're effectively, you may not be destroying the electron per se, but you are, in a sense, breaking the interference between these two amplitudes because by messing with the wave function, you're sort of collapsing it, in a sense. All right. So you can get some pretty strange things happening. And this whole idea bothers people, and people, one of the things people talk about is called the
Einstein, Podolsky, Rosen, and paradox. So they were bothered by this interpretation of quantum mechanics, and they sort of came up with this idea just to sort of make it sound extreme, which it is. Okay? So what they said was, and in fact, Einstein, I mean, they called the spooky action of the distance, this whole interpretation of quantum mechanics, just can't be right. Einstein actually, in spite of the fact that his 1905 paper on the photoelectric effect, for which he got the Nobel Prize, really launched quantum mechanics, more so than any individual piece of paper, I think, because nobody took the client very seriously until Einstein explained the photoelectric effect using exactly the same idea. In spite of the fact that Einstein was so essential in launching quantum mechanics, he never liked quantum mechanics, as far as I know. And one of the things that most bothered him was this whole collapse of wave function idea. So let us think about this. It turns out that photons have an intrinsic spin, we call it. So they actually carry angular momentum. And you can think of it as having an ambience. So we have to conserve angular momentum in the decay. So if I have a particle that decays into two photons, it will decay with them such that one has an angular momentum going this way and the other has an angular momentum going that way, so that the sum is zero. Or they're like this. But it's going to be this or this. And there are particles that we study called pi zeros that decay into two photons. The pi zero has zero spins, zero angular momentum transitively. And when it decays into photons, they're this or they're this. And when you detect a photon, you can tell whether it's this or this. When the pion decays, which is a quantum process, you have a 50% probability of this and a 50% probability of this. Okay? If they decay, don't know which, these particles go, they can go a long way. The wave function for this thing has to have within it the possibility of this or this up until the moment that one of them is detected. Let us suppose that I have way over here, pions decaying over here, I have over here a detector that detects one of those photons. And I detect that photon like this and not like that. Okay? The instant I detect it like this, that photon's state is determined. It will be this if you detect it. If I detect a photon on this side like this, that one is going to be like that. So I detected, I came to two photons, I know they're like this or like that. They go way apart. But they are still entangled, we call them. They still share the same wave function. And they are completely, 100%, totally, absolutely correlated. If I get this one like that, this one's like this. If I get this one like that, this one's like that. It's called quantum entanglement. And if you're wandering around the physics department or the optics department, you'll hear people mumbling about quantum entanglement all the time. Because it's one of the, it's very cool. People definitely start exploring. Yeah.
Wait, so do they have to have absolute angular?
Yeah, you have to have zero angular momentum. I mean, you conserve angular momentum, so the pion has zero. So that means they have to have equal and opposite angular momentum.
But this, what's so strange about that? Like, why is that?
Well, that's not strange. What is strange is that if I detect one over here, 10 kilometers that way, I determine what's happening 10 kilometers that way.
Yeah, because that's how you make the flux time using the universe. Like, I'm not sure like why that's so spooky. Because in order to make the flow time, you have to have oppositely charged, so you wouldn't expect the other photon 10 kilometers away to also be in the same direction, because that's not how you would make it in the first place.
But the uncertainty is entirely preserved.
Oh, it's still 50% chance.
It's 50-50 both ways, until I detect one. And the point is, if I detect this one, I have determined that, in spite of the fact that it's 24 kilometers away. I know what its state is. I know what its state is, even without detecting it. Because they are still correlated. They're still in the same wave function. So the moment I collapse the wave function, I don't just collapse it where I do the detection, I collapse it over all space. Yeah.
It seems that this is really readily explained by the wave function actually collapses the instrument
breaks. Okay, so yeah. It's readily explained by the wave function being collapsed, the instrument breaks. Exactly. But that's an instant, and that distance is 20 kilometers. So that's why it's spooky action at a distance, because what you have is a causal connection that happens instantaneously.
I mean, the instant of time.
The instant of time decays in this picture, we still preserve the 50-50 probability, because the instant of time decays, it could be either one of these.
But it is, yeah.
And we don't know which. And we don't know which until we detect one of the
people. We don't know which, but it's a change on the outcome. It's just going to put things off.
I think in the quantum mechanical picture of it, you have to preserve the possibility of that all the way out. So in Copenhagen's interpretation of quantum mechanics, you do not specify how that decay happened until you actually do the detection. In which case, you have instantaneous wave function collapse and you're breaking causality. There is another way of looking at it, which we're going to do, which is closer to what you were just saying. Yeah?
If you're going to use this to try to transfer information, say they're 10 light years away, and you detect one, so you know where the other one is. But somebody's 10 light years away and the other one, how do you tell them which one it is? Because you would know faster than the speed of light, but the face still would. Like if you're at column or something, say.
Well, now you're starting to get into the whole quantum computation, quantum communication idea. And I'm just the wrong guy to talk about that. But there are people who are real good at it around here. But yes, that's true. We could have a situation where somebody way over here can know what somebody way over here is going to see, in principle, faster than this person could communicate to you. Because they just have to detect the part of the quantum wave function over here. And then it's predetermined. It's determined in what goes. Yeah.
How is that different than if I'm sitting on one side of the room and I chuck a ball over the other side? How is that? I mean, I realize that the ball is going to hit the other side of the room before it hits the other side. What's particularly different with this situation?
Well, there's a difference between you realizing the ball will hit at some finite time later that agrees with causality and having that information instantaneously. In this picture, it's an instantaneous collapse.
All right. So
there's another way to illustrate the strangeness in quantum mechanics that's very similar to this whole entangled state thing. And this one is a thought experiment that Schrodinger came up with, so we call it the Schrodinger's cat example. And in this example, you assume that you have a radioactive atom here that has a 50% probability of decaying in the next hour, for example. Okay? And you have this detector that's set up, which has 100% efficiency, which if this thing decays and sends some ionizing particle through the detector will detect it, and the moment this detector detects it, it's designed to drop this hammer on this vial of poison, which releases the poison in the box and kills the cat. Okay, so you have this really charming sweet cat, you stuff it in a box, you close the thing, and now you wait an hour.
how do you interpret this quantum mechanically? So the quantum mechanical interpretation of this in Copenhagen world is pretty clear. The thing is, until you make a measurement, the cat has a 50% probability of being alive or dead. So quite literally, the wave function of the cat is basically this. It's a superposition state of dead and alive. And if you can't even say which is it, because you're not making it, that both have to be there, have to be part of this wave function, because you have a 50-50 probability of both. The very instant that you open the box and have an observation, the moment you gain knowledge about the state of the cat, you have instantaneous wave function collapse into one state or the other. And you don't know which, because it's a 50-50 probability. So if you do this with 100 cats, you'll have 50 dead cats. And probably a hell of a lawsuit if the SPS is going to be on. So it sort of sounds ridiculous, and it has this instantaneous stuff, and the whole idea of what this wave function is prior to making a measurement is nonsensical. You're in this sort of half-alive, half-dead state. It just doesn't make any sense. And again, Copenhagen interpreters would say it shouldn't matter because you never measure that superposition state. You never measure psi. You only measure that final state. And the moment you measure that, everything makes sense. Again, from the probabilistic point of view. Okay? But it has within it inherently this strange discontinuity, and it's uncomfortable to sort of think of this strange superposition state. Okay. Maybe there's a better way to do it. It's a guy named Hugh Everett, and I have posted on Blackboard, in fact, an article called The Many Worlds of Hugh by a guy named Byrne, which talks a little bit about the history of this guy and this idea. He was a grad student in 1957, and he had an idea that you really can't talk about just the wave function of a cat or just the wave function of a particle. In Hugh's mind, you actually have a universal wave function of which the cat is just a little piece. The particle is just a little piece of the overall universal wave function. Okay? And what he says is that within the overall universal wave function, every time you have a quantum event, in fact, everything happens. The moment you close that box, a way to think about it is that within this universal wave function, there's something of a split. And along one path, the cat's dead, and along the other path, the cat is alive. But within the overall large wave function, both actually happen. If we had a probabilistic thing, so there was like a 3/4 chance that the cat would be alive and a 1/4 chance the cat would be dead, if you were able to step back and look at the overall wave function, in a sense, the probability density associated with the live cat would be 3/4 and the probability density. So you preserve probability in all this. So this is commonly thought of or talked about, people talk about multiple universe theory, because in a sense you're sort of saying the moment a quantum process happens, you form a multiple universe where each of the things actually happens.
and we happen to be only sensitive to one of those paths. So, is that any better?
Is this a...
It turns out mathematically it is. It's a very elegant description of quantum mechanics, okay? But what's bothersome is it leaves a lot of other unanswered questions. Because there's a, pardon my southern description, there's a crap load of possibilities. Because there's a lot of quantum things happening all the time. So the overall universal wave function is a lot of paths happening all at once. Each of which is unique, but infinitesimally different from some other path. Because you can imagine, for example, that at this very instant a nucleus just decayed right here. Just before it decayed, you can imagine you had one universal wave function. It decayed, and then you have sort of a universal wave function where along one path that nucleus was present, and along the other path it had decayed. So it's an infinitesimal. So instead of thinking of it as a real bifurcation, you can sort of think of it as a continuum of possibilities happening all the time. So this is one very viable multiple universe interpretation that is exciting in the sense that we actually do believe quantum mechanics very well and experimentally supported. And this is a completely viable interpretation of quantum mechanics. You ask, can you prove it? Well, not really, because what does it mean here to have two different paths within this quantum mechanics? And what does a superposition state mean? So there's some weirdness there. We seem to be only, I mean, within the quantum mechanical picture of this cat, valid states would be live cat, dead cat, superposition, it turns out. Those actually would be all three. So if you were in this world, the superposition cat would also be a viable thread in the large scale wave function. But we don't seem to see that. And it turns out that these superposition states are highly sensitive to something which is called decoherence, which basically is even the slightest interaction, an oxygen molecule hitting the side of the cat or whatever, it will cause the superposition state to decohere into the sort of the basis states of live or dead. So if we find ourselves in the thread of the universe where we see a live cat, why is it we can't see the one where there's a dead cat? So one way to think about it is this description, this wave function description of the universe, in a sense has all the coordinate space of all the things that are there. So it has all the position space, momentum space, and everything that's there. Imagine you're doing a problem where you have multiple bodies, right? It's not just a three-dimensional problem, right? It's a many-dimensional problem because you have to have the position and momentum of every particle in the problem. So you have a big space, okay? So within quantum mechanics, the space of all things that you're dealing with, all the coordinates that you're considering in your quantum mechanical problem, is something which we call Hilbert space, okay? And you do not necessarily have to be sensitive to all of Hilbert space. Okay, you may only be sensitive to certain things. And I don't know that this is going to work, but let me try this. Let's imagine that we have a dog that can walk around the grocery store, and the grocery store has shelves that are either low or high. And the dog is not sensitive to anything on the high shelf because the dog can't get to the high shelf. But the dog is sensitive to everything on the lower shelf. Right? You can step back and see high level, low level. The ball could have some 50-50 probability of being on a high shelf or a low shelf. If it's on a low shelf, the dog perceives it. If it's on a high shelf, the dog doesn't perceive it. So there are threads in Hilbert space, which you argue you're sensitive to, because you're within that realm, but there are other threads that you're not sensitive to because you are sort of in different portions of the phase space. So that's a little bit the mental picture I try to carry around for this craziness. Not that I do this for a living, so. Yeah.
So it's the same thing with your electron gun?
Yeah, with the electron gun, you preserve all the possibilities up until it hits. But basically, you have a continuum of threads in the overall wave function that would follow the probability distribution that we're talking about. So that the moment the electron hits, you are in a thread where it happened to hit where you saw it. But in principle, in the overall universal wave function, in a way that preserves full probability, there are equivalent U's looking at, because you have to have everything else the same, right? Looking at a particle that hit somewhere else. So you have, within this overall large wave function, you would have a U looking at the dead cat, and another one you have U looking at the live cat. And within those pieces of those wave functions, they evolve differently after that, right? So you effectively have different universes. But they don't communicate. And they can't communicate because they're not in the same phase space. So it's pretty weird stuff. If you like this stuff, I wrote a book a couple of years ago called Visions of the Multiverse, where I actually talk about 10 or 12 different types of multiple universes. This is one of the major areas that gets the most press. And if you think this is interesting, you might want to read that book, or at least these sections of the book, because I do take my time and try to develop these ideas a little bit more carefully. But, and no, we're not going to have a test on this. Yes?
I was wondering, because instead of many worlds here, at least when it's here, when you say that there exists some world in which there is a superposition of states, is there any, many worlds or other interpretation that would conserve the long and given world?
That preserves the what?
Well,
what is that?
Some things that are in the world.
In the quantum mechanical world, the superposition states, in principle, if they do not interact with anything else, can exist. But, and in fact, I do, and then now I'm totally all on thin ice. If you go and you talk with Bob Boyd, or Joe Eberle, or Andrew Jordan, or John Powell, and probably some others over in the Institute of Optics, I believe they do play games and try to actually measure things like the lifetime of coherent superposition states, okay? And they measure things like how long it takes for them to decohere. And I believe, from what I understand, as of my reading a couple of years ago when I was writing the book, is that the decoherence happens when you have even the slightest interaction with other parts of the wave function, basically. And a way that... And so they decohere very quickly. So there is, for any practical purpose, unless you really construct a strange and artificial situation, you do have sort of a law that's really middle in the sense that so you're going to get kept alive. But the idea that you have a superposition state that has a decoherence time, I believe, is a very real and viable scientific thing. The level at which it's scientifically proven, I'm just wrong, or scientifically supported, so I'm just wrong about it. If that helps. Yeah?
So you're saying that when you shoot an electron through a double slit detector, you collapse the wave function and you cause interactions to happen, even if it's not destroying the state of the electron, there's some sort of interaction.
Yeah.
Why is it a larger scale electric field for gravitational field? So why is it that you can have a superposition state within a gravitational field, or is it really anywhere in space?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I understand what you're asking. It's a good question. And we're talking about a single particle effectively interfering with itself. So it has an amplitude coming from each slope. And then if I detect it back here, I collapse the wave function. So in that picture, I'm not really thinking of it as a coherent superposition of this and that, but maybe I am. I don't know. I'll have to think about that.
Actually, it seems as if the interaction with the magnetic field on a larger scale as opposed to coming through all the ones that wouldn't affect.
Well, it would affect both in a sense. So maybe in a strange way it's contributing to the amplitude in both cases and doesn't somehow. I don't know. I have to stop thinking about that. I should add, some of these experiments that are really weird in this business were done on the first year. Lynn Mandel and some others in the University of Europe made massive big shots in the world of quantum optics. So it's a very historical. We have the Mandel version of it. Doesn't mean I know exactly what it did, but I know it's cool. So, do you have any questions? Okay. So there are these two interpretations. There are other interpretations of quantum mechanics. So it's still very much something that people argue about, and maybe one of you will contribute to the picture with your own interpretation. Okay, it's not that. What I think is well known is outside of the strangeness of the instantaneous collapse, the Copenhagen interpretation certainly works well. And I should say that the many worlds interpretation gives you exactly the same answers. It also has some unanswered questions that people are working on, like why do we not see the superposition states? And I believe there's been a lot of progress with decoherence theory in the last 10 or 15 years that has sort of maybe helped them answer that. Another piece of it is I've done a little bit of research on it, I haven't quite figured out, is what determines that the basis states are stable with time, and that those are observable. So I haven't quite gotten my hand around that. But so people are thinking about, but in terms of the probability distributions that you would see, so if you ask, what is the probability I end up in a thread of the universe where the cat is dead or alive, you get exactly the same answer that you do with the Copenhagen interpretation. There is no way to distinguish the two, insofar as anybody knows. Okay, so there's another side of quantum weirdness I sort of wanted to talk about, and this one comes back to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. I mentioned that we have the one way of looking at the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, and that is, if, for example, I have a process that happens over a really, really, really short time, my knowledge of the energy of that process is limited. So what that means is that if I have a particle bebopping along and I want to describe it quantum mechanically, remember, quantum mechanics means that I have to take into account all of the possibilities. That's what it's all about. It's all about probabilities. So, this particle could go along, and it could just pop out another particle, seemingly breaking energy conservation. So long as this particle comes back in a very short time, that time over which it happened is so short that my knowledge of the energy is so uncertain, I actually cover myself. I can have it break conservation of energy as long as it does over a very short time. So short, you can't know. And it may sound absolutely ridiculous. Did you see it? I just made a ball go up here. But I did it over such a short time, you were not able to observe it. Entirely consistent with quantum mechanics. So long as I conserve charge and momentum. So you say, Professor Man, surely you did. What a ridiculous thing to say. Even if what you said were true, why should I care? For I cannot observe it. Right? It's true. However, when I do a quantum mechanical calculation, I have to sum over all the possibilities, including crazy things like that. And when you do that, it makes a difference. That area of physics is known as quantum field theory. So it may sound really bizarre, but here is our interpretation of forces in quantum field theory. Imagine I have an electron moving along. That electron has a probability that is allowed in quantum mechanics because of the uncertainty principle to emit a photon. That photon will have a certain energy. In other words, you are breaking energy conservation by the energy of that photon, if you don't think about it. That photon then can exist by the uncertainty principle for a certain amount of time. And effectively, it can go a distance of c times t. So I have this electron going along. That photon might have enough energy to pair produce in another electron, a positron, and an electron, and then come back together. So you don't think of the electron as an electron, you think of it as a cloud of these strange transient particles, which we call virtual particles. So the quantum mechanical picture of this electron really isn't me. It is a cloud of these virtual particles. Now, that may sound a bit weird, but there is a there's a real probability that these virtual photons pair produce and then come back together. You can calculate. And in fact, you can even find that they screen the charge of the electron because you have these pairs of electrons and positrons that because they're in the electric field of this electron are oriented a little bit. It's known as vacuum polarization. It actually affects energy levels and atoms and adjusts the spectrum. It's one of the things that people really believe in this stuff. Suppose this electron you visualize as a cloud of these virtual particles. They can have an infinite range because I can have an infinitesimally small energy for an electron. For a photon, sorry. So if I break conservation of energy by a minute amount, the delta T can be quite big. It can even be, so the distance times C could be even infinite. Which is why, okay, so what happens is if I have these virtual clouds, everything we talk about is I might develop them and then they come back together, and that's why you're in the wiser and nobody really cares. But imagine if I have some other electron over here, and they pass close enough that I have some virtual particle going that's emitted by this one and detected and absorbed by that one. It can carry momentum. A change in momentum over time is what we call a force. And this is the picture of a force in quantum field theory. We call it an exchange force. And you do have it classically. If you have two people standing on ice with a big, big, heavy ball, right? If I throw the ball to my friend, we exchange something, we exchange momentum, and we exert a force between one another. It's a little bit weirder in this discipline. You have attractive forces too, but so when we talk about the standard model, which works really, really well to describe all accelerator processes we've seen, everything, it turns out that it's entirely based on this strange picture of the force. So quantum mechanics is really weird. I'm going to come back to this. Hopefully, at the end of the class, I'll probably give time. We'll find time. I'm going to run out of time to do it formally in class. Probably, I'll probably set up a lecture. And one of the things I'll do is try to give you more of a feeling for
the different forces of nature and how they come out of this strange picture. But I think I wrote on the start of the slide, the starting slide here, the section of stuff in chapter 43 where this is discussed. And so it's sort of fun, but don't worry about it in terms of evaluation. I just wanted to float it out there for you. Any thoughts, questions, panic? Yes?
So would this happen unless it's an occurring fire? Or is this like an event?
It happens everywhere. To all forces. There is even, we don't have an actual functioning theory for gravity for it, but it's, we believe that one should exist if we were ever smart enough to figure it out. But we have viable theories for the strong interaction, the weak interaction, and electromagnetism that are entirely based on that view of things. And it comes completely out of the uncertainty principle, and it's really amazing.
That, like, if you can actually show that there are virtual particles that exist
Well, in a sense, we can never see a virtual particle. Because the only way you could detect it would be to supply enough energy to the system that it can live forever, in which case it's no longer virtual. It's a real particle at that point.
You can make a virtual particle into a real particle.
Yeah, yeah, that you can do just by putting enough energy in the system. So you then have to ask, what are the effects? I mean, one thing is, if you use this picture and calculate all the various things you can go into measurements of, you get it all right. I mean, to many, many decimal places. So in particle physics, for example, the quantum field theory you have that explains electromagnetic and strong weak interaction processes, we've been working for 30 years and haven't found anything that disagrees with it. But on top of that, you do have, for example, this idea that if you have the possibility for these electron-positron pairs sort of in states around an electron in an atom, they sort of screen the charge a little bit. They will adjust the energy of that state, which means it will change the spectral lines in a measurable way. And people have observed this. This thing called the land shift, L-A-N-D. Look that up. And you'll find this is a shift in a spectral line that you could not account for using standard stuff. That it actually requires this view of the force in virtual particles in order to understand it. It's a piece of strong evidence for quantum theory. So it's not that we have no evidence or anything. I mean, there are lots of effects. Okay. All right.
Can you measure the change of force? The force that happens.
In a sense, you do when you're doing the spectroscopy, right? You're actually looking at the energy levels, which are different. You know, you're looking at shifts in the energy difference between two levels when you look at the frequency of the light that comes out of that transition. So if I do something that slightly affects the energy of this level, I change the frequency of that spectral line. And people can do spectral spectroscopy with really high precision. So I mean, this kind of thing is measured. All right. Quantum weirdness. I'd like to, if it's okay with you, to now sort of revert back to something a little closer to reality, or what is easier to visualize. Just a reminder of where we have been. We have this non-relativistic one-dimensional time-independent Schrodinger equation, and we interpret this psi as the square of it times dv gives you the probability of finding a particle in some dv. And it's normalized in that we know that if we integrate that over all space, that we know the particle is somewhere. And to do any quantum mechanics problem, you basically put in the potential here that defines the physical system, and then you solve for what psi is, and you'll tend to get energies that are available as well. And you'll get some probability distribution, you know, you'll have some psi square then, and that gives you the probability distribution, and boom, there's your problem. So what would really be nice to do is to solve for the simplest atomic system and see if quantum mechanics can actually explain the energy levels that we seem to have in the same way or better than what Bohr was. Okay, because remember, Bohr was an amazingly successful model of the atom, but it was quite imperfect, and in terms of it being a ground-up theory, it was a pretty ad hoc in a lot of ways. The quantization was put in ad hoc. They had classical orbits, not really thinking of the electron as a wave, per se, and these where they are. So there are some imperfections. So what it would be nice to do is take this new theory, this new wave theory, and say, okay, we're going to put the electron, which is a wave, in that system with that potential, and we're going to solve it, and let's see what we get. So the potential that you want to use is a three-dimensional spherical potential, right? I have a certain charge here for the hydrogen atom. This is a plus E, and that's a minus E, and the potential goes as 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught in MKS system, E squared, so this would be ZZ over R squared, QQ over R squared. Except it wouldn't be squared because this is potential, not force. So this would be E squared over R. And I can't fix that right now because this is the wrong type of file. But you're okay with that if I adjust? All right. So there's an additional problem here is we really only looked at 1D. So in order to do a three-dimensional problem, we have to generalize this to three dimensions, which means instead of just the derivative with respect to space here, I have to put in a three-dimensional Laplace. And it's a spherical problem, so instead of doing it in Cartesian coordinates, we want to do it in spherical polar coordinates, because that fits the symmetry of the problem. So this is what you get. All this is just the Laplacian and spherical polar coordinate. This minus this R squared, this over R, is the V. That's the energy. Nice spherical polar problem. Remember, you've got R, you've got the angle theta, which is the angle with respect to the Z-axis, and you've got phi, which is the angle around, the azimuthal angle around. And so you solve. All right, so that's your homework set for this week. We're going to go through this in some gory detail. It turns out, and it's absolutely fabulous, this problem, as nasty as it is, and you'll get to do it if you get in your next quantum mechanics class, I'm not actually going to drag you through the solution here. It is exactly soluble. It's one of the few exactly soluble problems that we can do. But we can do it. And you can do it by assuming this psi, which is now a function of r, theta, and phi, is separable into an r function, a theta function, and a phi function. And you can plot that in here, and if you've done differential equations, you've done separably things. So you basically can plot in the psi as a 3, and you can separate this into 3 separate differential equations. One in r, one in theta, and one in phi. In the process of doing that, these are tied together. Okay, when you're separating them out, the way you do that is you have pieces that are equal to one another, and then you set them equal to a constant. That's the way it works. I'm not going to drag you through that, but when you do it, it turns out that you get the 3 equations that are solved. You get R pieces for the wave function, beta pieces for the wave function, and phi pieces for the wave function. And it turns out, so psi would be, for example, this R times the theta times the phi. You have, for each of these 3 quantum, each of the 3 differential equations you get when you separate it, each of them actually turns out to give you a solution that allows only discrete states. So for the R piece, when you solve it, you're allowed only discrete states that bring in a quantum number n, which turns out to correspond very closely to what Bohr's n level is. When you solve the theta one, you get something we call the orbital quantum number. When you solve the phi one, you end up with what's called the magnetic quantum number.
And what I'll do next time, I'm not going to make you feel warm and fuzzy about the actual solving of it, because that's just pain that you're going to put off for the next class. But I do want you to become pretty familiar with what comes out of it. And I guess the message that I will leave you with is, what is absolutely stunningly amazing, you can solve this exactly, and it gives you exactly what you see in the hydrogen atom. So if you didn't believe in quantum mechanics before this, you should believe in it now. So, all right.